Warning, this podcast contains bad words and stories about drugs and sex and overthrowing the government. Proceed with caution. Okay. Thank you. And now on to our show. Wake up, brother, we got nothing to do. Let's go outside, just me and you, and build a fort. We'll pack a lunch, won't be home till after dark. Then after dinner we can sneak back out. You know that high school girl I've been telling you about? Well, she gets undressed about a quarter to nine, and we can watch her do it from the big old pine next door. She got a room on the second floor. Well, looks like another fucked up day in paradise.
Hello, hello. It is the day after Valentine's Day. And if you didn't have anybody to be with on Valentine's Day, then may I offer myself in this luscious position here on the floor, waiting to be ravaged by you, man or woman, in the privacy of your own mind. Here I am. Hi, my name is Sri Fuji Split, aka Dan Kelly, the fleshy aspect of Hello World, that zany, self-aware catamaran built in Oceanside, California by Hobie Alter & Company in 1979 when I was just 16 years old. I also wrote and directed the sleekest little post-apocalyptic cult featurette ever to come off of the west coast of Michigan's Lower Peninsula, Daughter of God. And that's saying something, Mr. Frodo, what with the Latino-celebrated Dogman franchise and the upcoming Thaw of the Dead. I am still here after 25 weeks talking about how movies almost get made, scrying futures we may or may not crave with the help of yet another crystal sphere. This one's obsidian. Playing the glorious game of being the most me ever, which includes expanding the wilds of the earth, falling in love with everything, eating really well, and embarking on hilarious adventures. You are here for reasons known only to you. Together, we form an invincible power of podcasting, of global awakening. Come on aboard episode 025 of the Daughter of Godcast, Circles, and see how far we've traveled from post-apocalyptic featurettes, more than 100 miles. I keep reading that the post-apocalyptic genre is supposedly big in YA, or young adult, fiction, and for millennials too. Are they fascinated with the doom and collapse because the apparent global conditions do not inspire optimism? Are they visiting potential futures to get clear about which aspects of apocalypse might be worth encouraging and which brinks we should pull back from? Or has the rise of Trumpy amped up the chances of apocalypse in our lifetime? As for me, I can imagine some benevolent apocalypse. Here's an excerpt from my LinkedIn profile. It's critical that the object du jour is something worthy, hence my company's agenda about whooping ass for global consciousness. For example, peddling consumerism is right out. In fact, I'm all about bringing the consumer culture to a screeching, crashing halt ASAP. I don't work on projects that produce schlock or toxicity, that trash the earth or close perceptual doors. So there's my high road. High road! Americans got trained to pig out, to get really great at converting natural resources into landfill, which is very different from turning food into shit, at least if you compost your shit, like I do daily, and like I did while sailing on Hello World. Oh, wait a minute, hang on. Recent stats show a boost in our audience.
Yay!
If this is your first episode of the Daughter of Godcast, welcome. You might be feeling a little lost. Hang in there, exposition is inevitable. When you sail on a 16-foot catamaran for 300 miles, where to poop is not a trivial consideration. Where would you poop? Where would Jesus poop? Wild waters and poop don't mix well. Since sailboats don't need gasoline, we never pull over at the service plaza. The Barnes Park campground from episode 024, with its shiny white porcelain, was an aberration. I've mentioned the poopinator, the dung-o-matic. Are you curious about that? Sad to say, most people are pretty squeamish about their poop. Some things are just not discussed in polite company. In episode 023, I rambled about the start of the trip while spitting out the pits from the wild cherries I'd added to my breakfast. When I screened around Lake Michigan to a test audience in the fall of 2009, I got lots of written feedback about how rude I was for eating and talking at the same time, spitting out those pits. If folks are going to get so riled for that violation of Emily Post, how am I going to talk about the pragmatics of pooping on a catamaran? I happen to have here a copy of Emily Post's etiquette. This is the 1954 version, and I was looking at it to see if I could find anything at all about pooping. I looked under bathrooms and comfort stations and excrement, but there's like nothing. There's nothing in the contents, and there's nothing in the index here. Let's see here. Like, there's stuff about, I mean, they have freaking stuff about oranges, how to eat, on the street and in public, one maid in the home, personal letters, a servantless house. You know, so it's got a lot of information in there about all kinds of stuff, but nothing about poop or shit. So I guess you're just never supposed to talk about that in Emily Post. But I know some of you are game. For the rest of you, just hum really loud until you hear me say, "Okay, done!" And you may start humming now. I brought a watertight army surplus ammo box and a stash of peat moss. The ammo box is low and easy to sit or squat over. When I'm done, I add some peat moss, which soaks up any moisture. There is little or no smell. I don't use toilet paper, preferring to clean myself with water. The glorious mixture of poop, water, and peat moss deposited in the ammo box begins to break down pretty quickly, accruing interest in banking parlance. Yes, question from the audience? What happened when the ammo box got full? Well, answer. When I landed in a wildernessy location with loamy soil back from the beach, I'd bury the partially composted contents, which is called catholing in camping parlance. I never dumped in or near the water. A yes question. How did I do my thing on the boat? If the wind was mild, I'd stop sailing and use the dung-o-matic right on the trampoline. If I anchored in a public area, I'd set up my tent on the trampoline and then bring the poopinator in there for privacy. A question. Are there any other general comments that I'd like to share? Well, most Americans have an unsustainable relationship to their basic bodily functions. No matter how much college you've had, whether or not you're rich or beautiful, there's one thing you're really good at, and that's making brown gold. We are shit machines. There are so many of us, and we are designed to produce kick-ass fertilizer in quantity. Poop is not toxic waste or garbage. Poop is meant to go back in the soil and be utilized by plants, part of a lovely and amazing cycle. But what do most Americans do? Flush elsewhere. To an expensive sewage treatment plant or into the groundwater, exactly the wrong place for poop. Want to reimagine poop? I recommend the Humanure Handbook, available at Pals Books, or go to the page for this episode, and there's a link for a free PDF version. Okay, done! In conclusion, if Western civilization is that messed up about basic human functions, one might well imagine how out of whack we are with most everything else. Maybe a little apocalypse wouldn't be so bad. Maybe we have an abandoned daughter of God after all. Episode 025, Circles. Yeah. in episode 024, Dan and Hello World had landed on Beaver Island and found favorable conditions and friendly natives. Gretchen was helping out as a producer, and she knew lots of people on Beaver. My most excellent connection there turned out to be with Mason Dick Burris. Snorkeling with Dick. Posted on September 22nd, 2009 by Dan from undesire.com. Monday morning, while waiting to interview Dick Burris, the stonemason, I chatted with Doug Tilley, manager of the CMU Research Station, over breakfast at the Dalwhinnie Bakery. Dick and I connected later, two interviews in one day. We ended up riding out to the award-winning transfer station for yet another interview, and then taking a mask and snorkel excursion to the sunken car graveyard in Beaver Bay. They just dragged them on the ice and waited for them to fall through, said Dick. Dick decided to stay in the rubber duck while I dove. At 10 to 12 feet of depth, there were about 20 ancient autos in various stages of decay, even one with wooden spokes on the wheels. I spotted what appeared to be a lead-acid battery at about 10 feet of depth. I suggested to Dick that it shouldn't be down there, and he said, "Let's get it." After struggling to secure a rope to it, Dick tied me a decent slipknot, and I got it around the bulky zebra mussel-encrusted monster, slashing myself in three places. We hauled it up and brought it back, environmental remediation Kelly and Burris style. I made the mistake of taking my new iPhone down in its little waterproof bag, supposedly rated for 10 feet of depth. I shot pictures and movies, but a few tiny drops of water inside the bag afterwards boded poorly. The iPhone died about 20 minutes after returning to the dock. Fortunately, I had kept my older model and was able to activate it in the evening. Pictures and local blog postings? Gone. Reliable GPS? Gone. It's all good. The next day, Dick and I went back out with his underwater-ready Sony camera and dove an honest-to-goodness shipwreck from the 1800s, and then returned to the car graveyard. Dick and I talked a lot about his work as a stonemason. We took a tour of the grotto he built that incorporates diverse stone from all over the island.
Somebody said we had to initial it, so we hid it here in the back where you can see it.
So how old is this? How long have you been working on it?
Probably, I'm guessing 2 years old. Maybe it's three. This is the guy that used to paint stones. Some of this has gone and colored it. Put one of Archie's stones in there. He was an old islander.
And he painted these stones?
Yeah. Here's a Petoskey stone that somebody brought. Plum pudding stones.
That looks like quartz or something.
It is quartz. A lot of quartz on the island. So those eyes are out of limestone. That broke. Laid there, and I saw it all the time. I kept looking at it, and finally, when we did this little retainer here, I thought I had to put that in. Had to have the eyes of God looking out at it.
Oh, look, and here's that heart stone.
Oh, yeah. Helen and Al, yeah.
That's obsidian?
Yep.
That's here on the island as well?
Amy's son brought that.
A whale bone.
Wow.
A petrified whale bone from Mike Weed, the diver.
Iron ore. Where did I put that iron ore? There it is. This right here.
Oh, okay.
It's iron ore, very heavy. And that came off a shipwreck from Iron Ore Bay. That's why they called it that, because the water was all red and the ship went ashore. And it'd have to be probably eight foot deep.
That's not deep at all.
Yeah, no, you swim right down and get it, but you better not pick up too big a piece. You'll never get to the surface. I never saw so many beautiful rocks as there is on this island.
This led to his fascination with the ancient stonework of Peru and his travels there to see it firsthand. Was this the super technology of a sustainable civilization?
A completely different approach to building.
And then you wonder why they had all these different shapes.
Now, before you'd gone there, you'd obviously read about this stuff, but you were motivated to go see it yourself.
Yeah, that's right. And you can't believe it when you do see it. I have no conception of why they made these different angles.
Or how
they did it.
Why or how?
To such precision.
And so you've had a lot of experience at working with, basically the leading edge of modern day stone and block technology. And you go to this place in Peru, and it completely surpasses anything that you've seen today in your 40/68 years of experience.
To make some of these inverted angles where it goes into acute points like that, I don't think we could do it today.
Super technology of stone masonry.
Yeah.
And what else did they have going for them? What else did they, if they could figure that out, what else did they understand?
We found these kingdoms in such good order, and the said Incas governed them in such a wise manner, that throughout them there was not a thief, nor a vicious man, nor were there immoral people. The men had honest and useful occupations. The lands, forests, mines, pastures, houses, and all kinds of products were regulated and distributed in such sort that each one knew his property without any other person seizing it or occupying it, nor were there lawsuits respecting it. The motive which obliges me to make this statement is the discharge of my conscience, as I find myself guilty. We have destroyed by our evil example the people who had such a government as was enjoyed by these natives.
I read from the 1589 will of one of the last conquistadors, Don Mancio Serra de Leguizamo.
Look at that thing, it's a rebar hacksaw. That's a Peruvian inspiration?
I took a picture and put it up on the wall and followed the picture and made the hacksaw.
That is so awesome.
And it answered my question whether it was as good as a bought one or not. It's much better.
Bye bye, Beaver. Posted on September 23rd, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. Seemed like I'd stayed there for days and days, but it was only 4 days. Easy to get in the groove on Beaver with so many friendly folks around. I'm off to pack the boat and launch, with luck, Knobbinway today. I bought gear and parts at Power Hardware, washers to make a new pulley to replace the one I'd lost on the main sheet traveler, a new compass, an anchor bag. So many things vanish on the water. Securing gear is an important discipline that comes from hard experience. The list of things lost is long, not to mention things ruined, iPhone from trusting untested equipment. I mostly mourn the lost things, because now they are in the lake where they just don't belong. It's a double badness. I lose useful stuff, and the lake accumulates more crap. I also sent rent for my Brooklyn crib to my easygoing landlord, Phil Charles. The post office lady gave me a free postage paid envelope, because I only had my ATM card, and there was a minimum $10 charge. Is this a groovy place, or what? I didn't make it off Beaver until 5 p.m., so I popped over to Garden Island and camped, ready for an early morning departure between Whiskey and Squaw Islands. Marion and Zhongmun's son, Ari, was born a few days earlier. Marion had sent squares of cloth to her friends to make a collaborative art quilt for the newest member of our tribe. That morning, I pulled out and clamped Ari's orange square to the mast wire with the idea of charging it up with the wind and beauty. By the time I passed Whiskey and Squaw, it was gone. My contribution to Ari's quilt was to make it as big as all of Lake Michigan. The Upper Peninsula. Posted on September 24th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. I saw the Upper Peninsula of Michigan pretty quick, but my vector brought the coast up gradually. As the shore came into view, I could not see the rosy beige colors of friendly quartz sand beaches, but rather blue water breaking on gray shelves of stone. Not ideal for landing, but the wind was moderate. Simultaneously drawing closer and moving up the coast, the gray broke suddenly and familiar dunes and blowouts appeared. I swooped in for a landing, avoiding a cabin further north. Just as I landed, I saw a flash of blue through the trees to the south. Another cottage? I'd have to check this out before making camp. Hello World was awash in thick algae as I tugged her up. It was a sort of organic sludge that I'd never seen before. I quickly bopped up the beach to check out that blue flash and found tire tracks in the sand heading that way. Turned out to be a chemical toilet at a turnaround with fire pits. I'd stumbled upon a public access and not a soul in sight. Workable. I trudged back to the boat and warily observed the muck. It was mostly green, so how bad could that be? I dropped sail and made camp, deciding to sleep on the boat in case there was any sudden activity or vehicles from the public access. I would use the tarp rather than the tent to expedite my morning departure. I pumped the muck water and made stew, which turned out to be pretty yummy. Back in the woods behind the dunes, there were signs that the property was being carved up for sale. Why does everything have to be for sale? Intensity. Posted on September 25th, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. I jettisoned the sludge around 9 a.m. and headed southwest, with the intention of hyperjumping 40 miles across the UP and camping just past the Garden Peninsula on Summer Island. It was to be a short and very intense day. The wind was blowing from the northeast at a solid 15 to 20 miles per hour, and the swells were 10 plus feet from trough to crest. The first 2 hours were some of the most exhilarating and awe-inspiring I've ever lived. For those of you who ski or snowboard, think about moguls. Approaching a field of moguls at speed, the mind slips into a space where evaluation and reaction blend together. We observe our decisions rather than make them. And now imagine the moguls moving, rising up and collapsing all around, rushing at you, pulling away. A Hobie 16 has two basic controls, the tiller by which the rudders turn the boat and the sheet lines that control the tension on the mainsail and the jib, which determines how fast the boat moves. When running with the wind, the jib may not be so important as it is often blocked by the mainsail. On this day, only the tiller, direction, and main sheet line, speed, are relevant. A technical explanation begins. Airplanes are sucked up into the air, not thrust up into it. Airfoils, wings, are so shaped that air traveling over the wing is moving faster than air traveling under the wing, lowering the air pressure at the top because the fast-moving air thins out. Lower pressure, or vacuum, at the top sucks the wings up. A fabric sail can take a wing-shaped profile too, and that's the most efficient kind of sailing, enabling boats to go faster than the wind. Instead of going up, the sailing wing is pulled forward. When the wind is coming from directly behind the sailboat and the sheet is at right angles to the hull, the wing shape isn't possible because the wind only has access to one side of the sail. In this situation, the sail is pushed by the wind, so the speed of the boat is about the same as the speed of the wind. Loosening the sheet line allows the sails to swing towards 90 degrees, decreasing speed. Tightening the sheet with a corresponding change of direction enables the wind to travel past both sides of the sail, increasing speed. Keep in mind that going slower doesn't mean stopping. Running with a 15-mile-per-hour wind, the boat will be traveling about 15 miles per hour. The only way to apply brakes is to get out of the wind. Imagine a car that could only slow down if it turned 180 degrees. Might be tough to U-turn if you're going at 50 miles per hour. Wait a minute. 15 miles per hour isn't very fast. Going 15 to 20 miles per hour on a 16-foot Hobie in the big water feels like going 50 miles per hour on a motorcycle or 90 miles per hour in a car. Screwing up in any case could be bad. There's loose ropes to get tangled up in, big hunks of aluminum and fiberglass flying through the air if the Hobie flips. And, of course, plenty of water for drowning. Trust me, 15 to 20 miles per hour on a Hobie Cat is intense. Technical explanation ends. Esoteric explanation begins. Sailing is a collaboration between the crew, the boat, and the local manifestation of the universe. Think about this. The sailboat and sailor are a synergy. Alone, they can do nothing. But together, they form a unique entity, a sailing being. The sailor senses and acts with her entire body. The face and hands read the direction and speed of the invisible wind. The eyes take in sail telltales and shape, what the water is up to, and where the hell she is going. The body feels the swell and drop of the boat on the water, the pitch and roll of the hulls. The ears hear how the boat frame is twisting, the song of the rudders, how the water is rushing past the hulls and the bluster of the air as it interacts with the boat. In intense wind, complete body presence is required, an absolute activation of sense and ability. It's an ecstatic state, an excellent terror. Can a boat be conscious? I give my consciousness to the boat, and integrate myself, submerge or release, into the aluminum, the Dacron, and steel. I can think, but it's so not needed, and can even be a bit dangerous. I give my mentation to the synergy, and it spreads out over the whole being, into every rope and wire. What I am has fuzzy edges. My edges don't stop at my skin, or even the hulls and sails. I am the surging water, the moving air, the warming sun, or the ominous clouds. It's all relevant. Effective action in the center of a synergy is thought-free. I am not because I think. I am because I am. Once I let it out and open it up, consciousness is clearly everywhere. Getting in that space is to tap into true power. Esoteric explanation ends. Okay, so, enough exposition. Back to the story. I'm on a 16-foot Hobie Cat with about 500 pounds of cargo. That's the equivalent of three medium-sized sailors, close to the maximum crew capacity for the Hobie 16. 330 pounds of that is dead weight, backpacks that need to be shifted or secured for proper balance. Live crew would supposedly go where they were told without pushing and prodding. I am wearing a harness, hooked into a long wire attached to the mast. This lets me shift my weight to where it's needed to balance the boat. Left hand ready on the sheet line, and right hand grabs the tiller. There's a 15 to 20 mile per hour wind behind the boat, and 15-foot waves rising and collapsing all around, moving approximately in the same direction as the wind. Here's a taste of what inner dialogue might sound like if there was time to have it. The following paragraph would take about 3 seconds in real time, and my reactions would be automatic, without deliberation. We, me and hello world, tighten the sheet in, and turn slightly to the left, port, to rush up the sloping back of a big wave, lining up with the wave with a slight starboard turn as we reach the tippy top. As the wave crest white caps and curls, we teeter over the brink and hurtle down the wave's face, dropping 15 feet over 20 feet of forward travel, immediately loosening the sheet out, and sliding over to port to keep the forward tips of the hulls from digging into the bottom of the wave's trough. As the hulls glide into the trough, we sheet in to accelerate up the next wave. But wait, the next wave is already collapsing. We're in a wind shadow from the wave we just rode. Hard to port, sheet in and accelerate. Racing parallel to the waves, we find another wave to climb, faster. Don't let a big wave hit us broadside and roll us over. Here it comes, too late. Hard turn to starboard, ass to the wave, and surf it for all it's worth. Sheet out, turn to port, sheet in and up out of the new trough, quick. Sheet in, sheet out, weave back and forth, climb and surf for 2 hours. I felt fluid, automatic, intuitive. All the endless hours as a kid on the Hobie 14 came back to me, the Tai Chi like slow motion sailing and hardly a puff of wind, the hold on for dear life crazy ass blowing shouting for survival. All that time, I was just playing around, thrills and fun, of no consequence, no importance, or so I thought. That experience came bubbling up to serve me in the moment. I didn't know I knew how to sail like that. It was sublime. After 2 hours, the wind let up a bit, and I could come off high alert. Though it never felt like stress or unpleasant, just scary and wonderful. With all this heavy maneuvering, Ziliax's bike began to eat through its ropes. One bungee stood between me and total disaster. I had to stop for an emergency fix. To have a frigging bicycle dragging under the boat in these conditions would be unthinkable and horrific. So it was that I crash-landed on the next available spit of land. Coming in at a moderately high speed, we hit the shallow stony bottom and skidded over 50 feet with much crunching and grinding. I jumped off and secured the bike, while Hello World was rocked back and forth on her hard perch. Getting her out of the shallows was an epic feat, but at least we were back in the open water. I knew that Summer Island was just beyond the last point of the Garden Peninsula, but point after point passed without any sign of an island. After another hour or so of hard sailing, I started thinking about taking a break. To the north, a tempting blowout beckoned. I decided to turn right and give it a rest. 1 p.m. when we landed, 4 hours total transit time, with an hour spent fixing bike ropes and sidetracking to a rest stop. 40 miles in an intense 3 hours. A personal, phew, record. Summer Islands and Beyond. Posted on September 25th, 2009, by Dan from OnDesire.com. I spent the night at Dune Buggy Blowouts, my name for the sandy beach I detoured to after yesterday's intense push to Summer Island. From a mile or two away, it looked very inviting. Upon landing, I found tire tracks everywhere. I thought I might just take a rest for an hour or so and then continue sailing. But after taking inventory, I decided to make camp and get a fresh start the next day. I was pretty sure summer was just around the next point and could easily reach Stonington the next day if the already south wind showed up as predicted. The problem was finding a place to throw down a sleeping bag. There wasn't 6 feet of flat sand that wasn't covered with tracks. There were no motors whining at the moment, so maybe they showed up at night. I found a little bowl overlooking the boat and the bay, windblown to be sure, but free of tire sign. As I sat preparing dinner, the robot radio warned of rain, so I figured a tent would be in order. Yes, the wind would kick it about a little. No big deal. Early evening found me well-fed and inside the tent, practically paralyzed with fatigue. It was all I could do to take off my pants. Around 11:30 p.m., I awoke to the staccato slap of tent fabric. The wind had come up. I felt sand settling on my face as the tent was contorted and deformed in the blow. After lamely yearning for a lazy alternative, I resigned myself to retreat. Dressing and sorting out the explosion of gear around me, I moved everything about 50 feet away, behind a big dune. Just as I finished, zipped up the tent and lay down, it started to rain. Timing. I was back up at 7 a.m. and on the boat by 10 a.m. The wind was wrong for getting out of the bay, but I was able to pull in some cell reception and call Rich Brandstrom on the Stonington Peninsula, just around the corner and across the big bay Dunock. Eventually, I tacked out of the hole, turned the corner, and glided over to Stonington on steady south winds. The sun even broke through as I rounded Stonington and spotted Escanaba. An ominous sky as I approached the Summer Islands and the crossing of the big bay Dunock. I called Rich, all giddy at arriving with the sun still up, and asked him how to spot his brother's house, just 2 miles from the mouth of the bay. Oops. Rich explained that mouth meant where the bay starts, still 18 miles more to go. I asked him if he wouldn't mind coming to pick me up. I just wasn't prepared to sail another 18 miles in twilight. I beached Hello World against limestone cliffs on private property after getting permission from the owners and proceeded to unpack the boat and stow the sails. Rich, Anna, and Ellery arrived in time to help me roll the boat up to the cliffs, and we set off for their house in the Astrovan, home for Hello World during our stay on the Stonington Peninsula. Still in the UP. Posted on September 29, 2009 by Dan from OnDesire.com. It's 9 a.m. on Rapid River, Michigan, on the Stonington Peninsula. There's a big wind ready to blow me south to Green Bay and beyond. Robot weather reports are out of commission, as my little radio got wet on the trip across the Big Bay Dunock. I'm relying on windfinder.com, which predicted wind speeds falling to 17 miles per hour by 10 a.m. That's my tentative launch time. Theoretically, running with the wind matches boat speed to wind speed. So if I can handle the boat in this blow, then I'll make Wisconsin in an hour or two. Launch canceled. Rich and I drove up to the boat, and it's blowing 20 miles per hour steady with gusts up to 25 to 30. Chilly, too. I'll be here another day, looks like. Good for a blog update. Rich and I discovered several additional artifacts of sustainable civilizations in our interviews.
I can see things. I can't help but pick up a piece of driftwood and see a bird in it or a part of a person. And same thing with material, metal stuff. In the summertime, in my youth, I'd come up to the UP here, and I'd live with my aunt or my grandmother for a while, for a month in the summertime, and I'd hang out with my cousins. And one of my favorite pastimes was going to the Perkins Dump with my Aunt Karen, Cousin Toivo. we'd go there and we'd bring the trash, but Toivo and I, we'd always end up picking up more than what we were bringing there. And it was just, it was so much fun. There was just so much stuff. And I couldn't believe that people were throwing the stuff out. And we would load up and we'd bring it back and we would play with it or do things with it, you know. Like grates out of refrigerators. They were cool. So we built forts and we put them in as like screens. And, you know, we collected a lot of stuff from the dump. So, and I guess in my teenage years, I was working on cars and trucks and cutting up cars and making them into four-wheel drives. And you'd have parts and pieces left over. You get a bunch of steering linkage. Well, you look at them, and you know it looks like an arm. It looks like an elbow. So you got this thing that looks like an arm. Well, let's make an upper torso. Then, well, let's make a body, and that's how things happen. That's how I make sculpture. I find one piece that looks like something, and then I'll just keep adding to it, try to make the whole system. It is a blessing in many ways. It's a God-given talent. And I've been working with it and exercising it and grooming it for a while now. So, and I realize I need to continue doing that and see what happens, see where it goes, see what I can do. I'm affecting people. I'm seeing now that I'm affecting people. And yeah, I don't quite know how to take that. It's a power that, you know, it's a powerful thing.
Yeah.
People are being affected by this stuff that comes out of my shop that, you know, I pick up the pieces and combine it with some waste from you or my neighbor down the road or something that I've collected 20 years ago or picked up off the beach, and all of a sudden that thing almost has energy of its own, and people are affected by that.
Have you thought about that responsibility that you have?
I've been becoming more aware of that now. I never thought about that too much before. I didn't realize I even had that. But in the past year, I realized that there's this energy that I'm a part of that is way beyond me. So I'm just, I'm kind of tapping into it a little bit. I almost feel like a medium. When I go in and things are happening, I lose track of time and what day it is. I'm lost in my work. And to be able to get into that groove, that's when it's almost like pure bliss. You know, I'm just making things. There's a network of people. I don't even know half the people. I have people that I don't even know bringing me these things now. It's not just my friends and family. That's a group of folks that I have around here, but this group of people is growing exponentially.
And it's totally beyond your knowledge of who those people are.
In the past month, there's been dozens of people, dozens of couples, most of them have been couples traveling from elsewhere, just coming up to the UP in search of me or in search of the shop, and most of them are bringing things. I don't even know who they are. They read about me. Okay? So it's not just my friends and family, which is extensive, who are collecting a lot of stuff, a lot of things for me. There's other people bringing things from hundreds of miles away, states away, that I don't even know.
What do you think they're doing?
They want to be a part of this bigger thing. They want to make a change. They, instead of throwing these cast iron Kohler tub legs away, let's bring them to that guy in Upper Michigan. Maybe he can do something with them. Maybe they'll be incorporated in something. It's a crazy cycle. It's like coming full circle.
Ad hoc workshop poem, posted on September 30th, 2009, by Dan from ondesire.com. Trash, throwaway, toss, until the whole world is lost. But wait, there's no such thing as junk, only magical, sustainable funk. There's an anonymous, invisible army, finding rubber, glass, and metal, for creating amazing creatures that bark, buzz, and pedal. Rich,
Ellery, Anna, and Goober do the making shtick in a well-worn fix-it station not far from Shawie Crick. Just as the leaves grow, go, and grow again, and water falls, flies, and falls, ad hoc animals come to life and sound their secret calls. They speak to us of future. They remind us of the past. They help us pay attention. And, of course, they make us laugh. Heading east-southeast, posted on September 30th, 2009, by Dan from OnDesire.com. To Wisconsin! The Wind Blew Me Home, Chapter 1, posted on October 1st, 2009, by Dan from OnDesire.com. So long, Stonington Peninsula, photo by Rich Brandstrom. There I was in Wisconsin waters, having just passed between Washington Island and the Door Peninsula. 28 miles in 3 hours, a decent trek for one day. I'd left Rich and Hello World's caretakers, Bunny and Ed, at noon near the limestone cliffs of the Stonington Peninsula and caught a brisk wind south. A delightful ride, save for my nearly frozen feet. Too much strolling around in the little Bay du Nac, preparing to launch. Also, a bit of confusion along the way about which shimmering mirage was actually Washington Island. Too much western slide, and I could get sucked into the funnel of Green Bay. I'd just tiptoed over the shoal between Plum Island and a tiny mainland town not shown in my charts when it happened. The wind kicked in with a magical tingle, the tiller gave a little jump, and Hello World swept away from Wisconsin, back out into the open waters of Lake Michigan, not finding any stuck linkages in the rudders or snagged sail lines. I concluded that mystic powers were at work. Based on the southeast course, the next landfall would be Point Betsy, 44 miles away. 3 p.m. was a little late to start the Big Lake crossing. But the wind was a friendly northwestish at 8 knots, 7 miles per hour. The sun was shining, there was plenty of food, and what the fuck. It was a steady ride. An hour or two later, I could discern a shimmering shadow on the horizon. A very prominent point, or an island. Point Betsy could not be sticking out so much. Perhaps this was an enchanted island, impossible to chart and reachable only by a special boat, such as the very one I was not quite sailing. The shadow to the southeast grew and darkened to a silhouette, while the sun sank towards the horizon. Time slowed, and all events extended into infinity. The island, for certainly it was an island, forever getting closer, the sun ever dropping towards the water's edge. But neither did the island arrive, nor the sun set. I successfully took pictures of this state of events, establishing hard evidence that reality is variable. Sailboats sailing themselves is one thing, but a deactivation of the space-time continuum? Come on! Eventually, the island got close enough to be identified. North Manitou. There were the great sandy bluffs north of Crescent City. Still the sun sank ever closer to the horizon without touching it, let alone pass behind it. I could see the potholes and blowouts to the north of the island. I wondered how I could safely land without lights to guide me in, for North Manitou is maintained in a state of wilderness, no houses and no fires. That's when the full miracle manifested. I noticed a nearly full moon hanging over the island. When the sun passed, the moon would guide me in. I gobbled some vegetarian heat fuel in preparation for the final approach. Raisins, sesame butter, and mild cheddar all mixed up. Now that our destination was obvious, I was back in control. The wind was getting more intense now, and I was on the wire. That is to say, I was harnessed up and attached to the trapeze, counterbalancing the push of the wind by standing out away from the boat. A grand sight for any late-season campers equipped with magnification. Hello World dashing towards them through the swells, sails ablaze with orange sunset, sailed by a mad shaman, standing back and flipping perpetually overboard, sheet in one hand and tiller in the other. A grand sight from my angle, no doubt. I had switched on my little nav light for some pretense at legality, but its light blinded me, and I missed Crescent City by 100 yards. We crashed up on a wide sandy beach, clunking a few rocks at the very end. I jumped off, waded to the bow, and immediately fell into the surf, the sheet line wrapped around my legs. It was now about 9 p.m., and I was chilled and shaky. Hello World was banging up and down in the surf. I had to get her unloaded and properly beached. I dragged Pax off her in the moonlight, dropped sails, and after an hour or so, had her safely up. I struggled into the camping pack and followed what I thought was a wash up the bluff, but turned out to be a trail to an idyllic campsite. Popped the tent, climbed in, and fell into a coma. The Wind Blew Me Home, Chapter 2. Posted on October 3rd, 2009 by Dan from ondesire.com. It's best to start the morning slowly after a 9-hour enchanted sail, to take a languid inventory of all your parts, cozy warm in the sleeping bag. A trip down to the boat for toothbrush and iPhone charging gear, a sauntering walk in an open sunny field to brush up the teeth and make a nitrogen-rich deposit, lazing in the tent with a light breakfast of cheese, raisins, and sesame butter.
Well, been awake for a little while now. Yesterday we were in the western UP, and we sailed down to Wisconsin, to Washington Island, then across the lake. Oh, started at 12 and probably ended around 9, so that's 9 hours, and that's about 60 miles of sailing. What can I say? The wind just blew me home. Gonna pack up, and we're gonna sail to Point Betsy, where we'll land the boat, and then we will ride our bike back to the house, and if Patrick is there, we'll requisition his car and go back and pick up the rest of the bags in one trip. And then another trip with the mast and the trampoline. That's kind of weird with this hazy thing. Let's wipe this off. Because it's not really foggy in here. I was just kidding. This is morning dew. There, how's that? That's kind of a cool shot.
Welcome to my lair.
Downstairs now, here's what we're going to do.
The iPhone is out of batteries, and we kind of want to look at our chart to plan the best route.
So, what I'm going to do is, I'm going to go downstairs to where the cat is. And then I'm going to remove the battery and charger for the iPhone and come back up here. And then I'm going to have my morning hygiene. I'm also going to grab my toothbrush while I'm down there. I'm going to have my morning hygiene. And I'm also going to check the wind out while I'm down there and get a guess of what we've got for wind right now.
So we'll come back up here with a knowledge of the wind, battery for the iPhone, and a toothbrush,
and then I'll brush my teeth and do my little thing that people do, and then I'll pack up. No, then I'll come back to the tent and climb in the sleeping bag again, and I'll look at the charts and get a course figured out, and then I'll pack up here and we'll launch. And by that time, the iPhone should be fairly well charged. I have a feeling it's pretty windy out there, so I don't think I'm going to want to charge the iPhone en route.
It would be nice if I could dry out some stuff, but
it is sort of sunny, but I don't know if it's sunny enough to actually dry out a wetsuit or this clothing that I have. I'm probably going to have to put on new dry long johns and get them wet on the way to Point Betsy. So, and maybe I'll have a little breakfast and then get ready, and we'll go. Go the rest of the way, back to Point Betsy and home. Oh, life is great. Life is so good.
So it's the last day. Well, in theory it's the last day. It could go on for a little bit longer. But I got a late start today, but a late night. So, we'll see what happens. We'll just kind of ride this out for a while.
pretty lovely day. It's just a little cool, not exactly brisk. Very comfortable. I don't have my whole wetsuit on right now. I don't even have my gloves on. And I just lost a sock, it looks like, because I found a sock floating in the water that was mine as we drove along. I had to go back and get it. So I'm assuming the other sock is somewhere in the deeps. And I thought I remember putting those socks away, but I guess I didn't. I guess I put them away and took them out to dry them and then forgot about them. Tisk tisk. So I gotta make a list of things I've lost on this trip. So many things. Let's see, I lost a plastic burrito wrapper from Oriana, and I lost pieces of the compass when it blew up, the bezel. And what else did I lose? I lost my paddle, that was the first thing I lost. And today I lost a sock. And I'm gonna make a list. Those are just some of the highlights of things lost on this trip. Things that went into the water, never to be seen again. Oh, and the airy flag. Disc, disc. But maybe that's part of the grand scheme of things, the airy flag going into the water. Maybe he'll be a sailor. He'll be a very fluid person. He'll be blessed by the water, as am I. All right, well.
After much tacking and fitful wind, I finally approached and cleared South Manitou at 5 p.m. The wreck of the Francisco Morazan, standing out in the sun, was a temptation. I'd never been able to approach from the water, much less board her. That expedition would have meant another night camped, and now that I was only 19 miles from my home turf, I felt ready to finish, even if it meant sailing into the night again. Also, who could say what the wind and weather would be tomorrow, or the next day? Sans robot radio and cell phone connection, not me. An ore boat on the horizon. My charts gave me a heading of 193 degrees, and a half an hour later, I could see some smudges on the far southern horizon, my destination. The wind was blowing me home now to the south, and then eventually providing real power from the east. As Point Betsy grew, I kept looking back at South Manitou to gauge how much I'd traveled. The big bluffs were still towering over the water 10 miles away. I had never realized how easily one could spot the Manitou Islands from Point Betsy. No wonder John Barnes had lusted after them. He and Joe Sturgis had done this trip on their 16-foot Hobie Cat almost 20 years ago, and everyone thought them crazy kids. I decided to head to the westernmost edge of the point rather than follow the bearing offered by my chart. I hadn't been adjusting for declination on the trip, and I suspected that that was why the chart offered the odd bearing off to the east. There's a reason it's called Point Betsy. The lighthouse is at the end of the point. There was some question whether the light in the lighthouse was actually operational. It had been years since I'd been there at night, and the complex had been mostly decommissioned and sold to private parties many years ago. I spotted the Frankfurt Airport light, past the bluff and behind Crystal Lake about 10 miles. Crystal Lake. The artist house and my Benzie Rook were about as close now as Point Betsy, if Hello World could go airborne. The west was gray and overcast, so that the last hour of the sun's progress was hidden. There would likely be no sunset watchers at Point Betsy to greet me. I was judging how much light I had left by the official sunset time from windfinder.com, 7:44 p.m. It was just about that time when the lighthouse began flashing at me. Yee-hoo! I really felt a homecoming now, like a mariner of old returning to home port. The wind was stronger, and I even got a little song out of the rudders as I flashed past the lighthouse. The moon was like a streetlight, bright and white on the beach. As I turned into the beach, the wind just shut off. I made a couple of feeble passes back and forth before finally landing with a crunch. I threw all the bags off and dragged up Hello World, using the bow-long fenders under the hulls as usual. It was a good hour before she was 6 feet from the surf, sitting prettily on her bowlongs. I repacked her for the night, removing only the bike, the prepared food bag, and the dry bag containing the precious cargo of Project Hard Drive and computer. I hit the road and biked the 6 or so miles back to the house. I was in the tub soaking and sipping stew by 11. The next morning, I started catching up on the blog. My plan was to call Patrick as if from the boat and ask him to go to my house to look for something. Then I'd surprise him by being there. My brother Steve called to ask where I was. I made some misleading references to Wisconsin and so forth, telling him that my actual location was secret. Patrick called me back later and told me he'd drive to my house in 45 minutes and would call me from there. After about an hour of waiting for Patrick, I got a call from Justin at the Coast Guard. Did I have a boat called Hello Kitty at Point Betsy? There was a report that it was half in the surf, and he wanted to know if there were people that needed searching for. I assured him that no search was needed, and that I'd be picking up the boat later that day. Half in the water? I checked Windfinder, and sure enough, the easterly wind had picked up over 30 miles per hour overnight, possibly blowing Hello World off the beach. Shit, where was Patrick? I called his cell without getting through. I then started to worry that maybe something happened to him. He was running pretty late now. I forgot all about my clever surprise tactics and just waited for him to drive up. When he did, I jumped in and said, "Let's go to Point Betsy." Off we went. Sure enough, Hello World was being sucked into the surf, her gear hanging off precariously. The bow longs were long gone, but amazingly, everything else was there. We threw off our shoes and socks and waded into the frigid surging waves to do battle. Struggling against the sucking surf, we tossed off all her baggage and began wrestling her up. I had left one of her hull drain cocks open, and water and sand had packed itself into the hull, increasing her weight. Not good. With a few clueless tourists looking on, we eventually muscled her up high and dry. All the baggage and sails went into Patrick's Subaru. We dropped the mast and lashed it to the roof rack. Much lightened, we were able to drag her all the way to the dune grass. While we were there, John Anderson from Detroit showed up. He had phoned his brother with the project URL, and they had checked out OnDesire.com, got my information, and phoned the Coast Guard. He'd even tried to pull her up with help from some bystanders. So, not all tourists are clueless. My apologies. John Anderson, hero. Point Betsy Recovery, photo by Patrick Kelly. I put a request into Jim Barnes to borrow his van. He had a catering job the next day, but he was pretty much ready and would be happy to give us a hand. We drove to his house, and the three of us jumped into Jim's van after unhooking the catering trailer and sped out to the property where he kept his Hobie 16 and trailer. We offloaded his Hobie and dragged the trailer over to Point Betsy, where I waylaid a sunset watcher from Springfield, Illinois, to help drag Hello World to the road. The four of us together huffed and puffed her up to the trailer, suffering no serious injuries in the process. I thanked our friend and sent him back to the water with plenty of time to see the sun sink. Getting her up on the trailer and strapped down in a jiffy, we were off again to my place to dump Hello World gently in the driveway. Another trip back to Jim's property, where we put his Hobie back on his trailer, it was dark now, and finally returning to his house for a beer and sandwiches. Phew! Patrick and I eventually returned to the house, where I taught him to smoke sage out of the old flintlock pistol. In mid-October, I returned to Brooklyn and cut the movies I've been playing during the recent Daughter of Godcast episodes. I scheduled November 28th for a test screening of Around Lake Michigan at the Mills Community House in Benzonia. Gretchen had been getting into dance and wanted to debut her first performance at the screening. Melanie and her squeeze Sean jumped in to debut their new music collaboration, Saldage. Suze McLaughlin came in as a caterer. After an intense month of promotion, we packed the Mills to capacity with 150 artists from all over Northern Michigan. After the screening on December 15th, I drove back to Prospect Heights in a rental car. The 2009 expedition had been a successful proof of concept. There were artifacts of future sustainable civilizations to be found. A 16-foot Hobie Cat was a viable production platform. I could thrive in the making. I was now in full pre-production for the second expedition of Around Lake Michigan, a circumnavigation of Lake Michigan starting in the spring of 2010. My days in Brooklyn were coming to an end. I would give up my apartment and return to Beulah. You've been listening to the Daughter of Godcast, episode 025, Circles. I sailed 300 miles solo and didn't die, and together we've completed 5 years of ancient history. That's an average of 5 episodes per year. With 7 more years ahead, we might have 35 more episodes before we catch up to the present day. These were years dense with adventure, and I'm raring to share. By summer or maybe fall, we'll be together in the now, and what then? Just another beginning.
We found these kingdoms in such good order, and the said Incas governed them in such a wise manner, that throughout them there was not a thief, nor a vicious man, nor were there immoral people. The men had honest and useful occupations. The lands, forests, mines, pastures, houses, and all kinds of products were regulated and distributed in such sort that each one knew his property without any other person seizing it or occupying it.